The Tom Woods Show, episode 1342.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, Bob Murphy is going to have to be carried out on a stretcher after I am done with him aboard the 2019 Contra Cruise. We are debating pacifism. Bob in favor, me opposed, with Gene Epstein moderating. It's going to be a great time, but it's going to make my demolition of Michael Malice in the Hamilton debate look like a picnic. This debate is for Contra Cruisers only, so make sure and grab your cabin right away at ContraCruise.com for the libertarian event of the year. That's ContraCruise.com. Oh, and don't forget, bring some dark clothing for Bob's funeral. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I am sharing with you a talk I've never shared before. Seems like I have an infinite supply of these, doesn't it? I did a lot of public speaking when I was a younger man. This is from 10 years ago, if you can believe that, when I was speaking at the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. So I went and talked about the financial crisis, because, of course, I had written a book on that, Meltdown, and I talked about the economics of it, but they also, no doubt, being the Acton Institute, wanted some kind of a moral dimension to it. So I tried to raise some issues along those lines. So it's not my usual laughy, bantery kind of talk. It's somewhat more academic, but not boring, I don't think. I think you'll get something out of it. I think you'll enjoy it. It's not like any of my other talks on this subject. And by the way, happy news, I didn't even know it was out. They didn't even tell me. The publisher has issued, finally, a paperback edition of Meltdown. Meltdown did so well in the hardcover, they just kept it in print in hardcover all these years. They never released a paperback edition. So they finally released a paperback edition with a new introduction by me. So you can pick that up, obviously, on Amazon and so forth, but I will link to it at tomwoods.com/1342. Where you can click on it and go get that book and enjoy it. I've had a lot of people say it converted them or they finally understand the Austrian business cycle theory because they read it. And you can also get the audiobook version read to you, not by me, unfortunately. I'm not the narrator of it, but you can get the audiobook version for free through the Audible offer at tomwoodsaudio.com. So the links here are tomwoods.com/1342 and tomwoodsaudio.com. But anyway, I'm really glad that now there's a paperback version of that book, much more affordable, and I think you'll like it, and I'm really happy with that book. I worked my tail off to be able to get an Austrian perspective on the crisis out in time before it was bombarded by every other person in the world writing a book on that subject, and it spent 10 weeks as a New York Times bestseller, so we did manage to get the word out to a good number of folks. Anyway, so for today's episode, you're going to hear me addressing the Acton Institute, and my opening remark about the fire marshal has to do with how crowded the room was, so that was actually really gratifying to see. All right, here we go.
Let's get myself situated here. We're going to get this open. Wow, my goodness. Good job. I won't tell the fire marshal if you don't. Good. That's nice. I have no idea what this thing is. Is it just for looks super sophisticated? But I'm very low tech. I don't use PowerPoint because I feel like it's just a crutch. But also, I'm just too freaking lazy to put a PowerPoint together. That's the real reason. But I couch it in this moralistic idiom of that it is corrupting the purity of the presentation and so forth. What I want to do is talk about, of course, what's been going on with the economy, but I want to suggest that this really is an opportunity for us to ask some moral questions. And I know there are people who believe that this economic crisis should be leading us to ask questions about greed and so on and so forth, but I don't think these are really the correct moral questions. I don't think they're helpful moral questions. But that doesn't mean there are no moral questions that need to be addressed, and I think this is a good opportunity. A systemic crisis such as the type we're living through is a good opportunity to raise and answer some of those questions. So that'll be, in effect, the second part of my presentation. The first part is going to set the stage by giving some background as to what's going on, because we can't render moral judgments without the facts and without an understanding of what's happening. Now, I trust that in this room we've got a diversity of people in terms of how much stuff you read about economics. I know we're all interested in the subject, but you know, not everybody reads Ludwig von Mises' book, Human Action, 900 pages. You know, that can be tough going for some people. I'm a dork. I love this book. I listen to it in audio format, which we have made available little by little at the Mises Institute for free. You can listen to the whole thing for free in your car. If you're driving to Spain, let's say, you might, or driving to the moon or something, you could listen to this thing. But so I know there'll be people in here who are super duper experts who, you know, could come up and give a much better presentation than I can give. And then there are other people who will be coming to these ideas for the first time. So I'm going to try to accommodate everybody. I want to start off by looking at one of the sort of root causes of what we've been experiencing. And it is a root cause that has been, by and large, neglected, although in recent months we've seen more attention paid to it. And that involves the subject of central banking and the Federal Reserve System. This is very important because of the connection between the policies of Alan Greenspan and what we're living through now. Now, there will be people in any audience that when you mention the Federal Reserve System, they think, okay, where's the exit? I got to get out of here. This is going to be too technical. No, I promise it isn't. They want you to think it is so that you'll say, I better just leave our wise overlords in charge of these things because, I mean, I don't know any better, right? I'm just some peon. No. Don't sell yourself short here, okay? There are some fundamental points that all of us can grasp. In fact, the only people I find who have any trouble understanding any of the points that I'll be making today are, unfortunately, Nobel Prize winners in economics. Otherwise, the average person, I don't want to mention any names, Paul Krugman, couldn't. Haven't quite achieved that level of self-mastery that I've been aiming at. But anyway, so what I want to do is introduce you to an idea that some of you may be familiar with, but then I'm going to elaborate on this idea and look at what the moral implications of it are. And this is the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Now, I've been in a situation where, I guess it was September of last year, I was speaking at the Target Center in Minneapolis, and there were thousands and thousands of people out there. I've never spoken to a group quite that big. Usually when you say, hey, everybody, we're going to come talk about business cycle theory, people don't say, well, I'm dropping everything and going. But it was a huge crowd, and I think they might have been there to hear this, I don't know, there's some Congressman Ron Paul or something, but something like that, but I was there too, and so I gave this little speech, and I said, you know, it's interesting that a lot of people are getting more interested in the so-called Austrian theory of the business cycle, and the place erupted in cheering, and I was so thrilled because I thought two things simultaneously. Number one, it's wonderful that these ideas that are so critically important at this moment are so widespread now that people recognize them and cheer for them, and then secondly, I thought, the dorkiest people in America are all in the same room right now. That is great. So that's what I want to start with right now, is the so-called Austrian theory of the business cycle. The term business cycle just refers to the phenomenon whereby our economy seems to move cyclically, like we're all doing great, and then we're all doing badly, and then great, and then badly. And the attempt to explain, account for this phenomenon has taken a number of turns. I mean, the Marxist explanation is that this is the working out of the contradictions of capitalism. Of course the market is going to move up and down. That's part of the problem with it. There have been psychological explanations that investors get carried away. There are animal spirits in the economy. So at one time they're super optimistic and they invest like crazy, and then for reasons we can't begin to fathom, they become pessimistic and then everything goes in the toilet. Well, again, this is not really a full explanation. If that were the explanation, then we should devote all our research and development resources to inventing a happy drug for investors so that they would never become pessimistic. It seems like this can't really be the explanation. So this is what F.A. Hayek was seeking to answer. Why does the economy seem to move like this at all? What's making it do it? What is causing what the British economist Lionel Robbins called the cluster of error? Because what's going on in the economy normally is that it's true, you do have businesses going out of business. That's inevitable. But we can't be perfect forecasters of the future. That's going to happen. Somebody selling porcupine on a stick is going out of business. I saw that in a cartoon once. It's, you know, that's nobody wants that. So it's going out of business. So that's because the porcupine entrepreneur failed to anticipate consumer demand correctly. But the question is, why are they all going down? I mean, not literally all. I mean, pawn shops are doing very well right now, you know, check cashing services, whatever. But really, by and large, you're seeing a lot of a big downward trend. And the thing is that the free market normally tends to weed out entrepreneurs who are not good at anticipating consumer demand. So the porcupine on a stick guy is weeded out. He makes losses and or goes out of business. But the guy who, you know, sells regular popsicles, well, he makes profits and therefore he gets command of more resources. He gets rewarded by the market. So the market tends to weed out the bad people who are not skilled at this and reward people who are. So it's doubly interesting to wonder why would these particular people of all people suddenly be caught out having all made the same type of error simultaneously. This seems to demand explanation. So Hayek, as I say, Hayek wins the Nobel Prize for his explanation. And you may say, okay, but big deal, a lot of doofuses have won the Nobel Prize. Why should I be impressed by this? But the answer is that Hayek is saying something that is not what the Nobel Committee wants to hear. A lot of the prize winners have kind of said what the committee wants to hear. Hayek says, by and large, the opposite, and he wins. So I suggest to you that that means something significant. So we're talking about the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Why Austrian? Because the school of thought that originated it is known as the Austrian School of Economics, simply because some of its early practitioners happened to hail from Austria. But today it has no connection to Austria. There are more Austrian economists, you know, economists working in this intellectual tradition in the U.S. Than there are in Austria. So we're talking about this particular school of thought. And last night when I was speaking at the Grand Rapids Legatus, I had my Mises Institute tie on, which has the coat of arms of the Mises family. Ludwig von Mises, M-I-S-E-S, lived from 1881 to 1973, was extraordinarily productive, had a very, very interesting and eventful life. And he was the one who first originated the business cycle theory that we call Austrian business cycle theory, that tries to explain the cyclical nature of the economy. And Hayek's elaborations on this theory in the 20s and 30s won him the Nobel Prize in much, much later, in 1974, but it was for his earlier stuff. It's for the Hayek that most people who even have read Hayek have actually not read. Most people who like Hayek have read The Road to Serfdom or Constitution of Liberty. They haven't actually read his economic stuff. His economic stuff is actually very challenging to read. There were people at the time, economists, who said, you know, well, as he was writing in German, they said, well, as soon as they translate him into German, maybe we can understand it. So he was not the easiest guy to follow, because the stuff he's talking about is very, very technical. But Mises had an interesting life in the sense that he taught for a while lived in Europe for most of his life, taught in Switzerland for a while, and then as Europe became dominated by the Nazis, it became a not very congenial place for a guy like Mises, not only because he was Jewish, but because the economic teachings he was setting forth were really not in line with what the autarkic National Socialist government wanted to hear. So they confiscated his library and papers, and he wound up fleeing Europe in his late 50s, arriving in the United States in 1940, almost empty-handed, and not speaking a word of English. So it looks as if the guy's life is over, right? What's he going to do? And to add insult to injury, he does not get a paid university post in the U.S. He has to take an unpaid post at NYU, where he is appointed as a visiting professor, where he stayed for over 20 years. It's a very long visit that he paid to NYU. And so how did he get paid? He got paid by a consortium of businessmen, the William Volcker Fund, that came together, realized the significance of what Mises was doing, and he needs to be supported. And they paid his salary. So he was viewed as this very old-fashioned, quaint little old man who holds little seminars about the free market. Well, it turns out that Mises winds up, even though it seems like this is it, right? Everything is just shot. He arrives in the U.S., he's got no prospects, yet he has probably the most productive years of his life. In the 1940s, he publishes three books, 1949 being Human Action, his gigantic treatise on economics. He continues his productivity into the 50s. And today, 36 years after his death, all those people he was passed over by for all the top university positions, the vast bulk of them are long forgotten. They made no contribution to the discipline whatsoever, whereas Mises' colleague, who built on his work, won the Nobel Prize the year after Mises' death. Mises has an institute named after him where it's my privilege to work. And students are learning and profiting from him and his teaching to this day. So it's quite interesting, and very recently there's become a little bit of a renaissance of interest in Austrian economics. The Austrian School of Economics is the oldest continuously existing school of economics in the world. It is also the smallest right now, but at the same time the fastest growing, because people are curious to know why is it that disproportionately the people who predicted this crisis disproportionately belong to the Austrian school. What insight did they have? Now, let's contrast this, by the way, with the fact that every time there is a crisis like this, you can bet that the first response you're going to see on TV is our wise public officials assuring us that no one could have foreseen this, right? This just fell out from out of the blue, right? No one could possibly have foreseen this. That's the kind of Orwellian aspect of all this, because people did foresee this. Mark Thornton, who's in the office right next to me, you can look at his article archive about the housing bubble and talking about all this, where it's heading. I mean, he did see this, right? I mean, and there are other people you can point to. They do exist, right? They did write things. But yet, just a couple months ago, we had Joe Biden saying, yeah, well, you know, I mean, who could have seen this coming? Yeah, I guess no one you hang around with could have seen it coming. However, you are not the entire universe. Sorry to break this to the vice president, which is a real discovery. So what is it that Hayek says? What answer does he give? Well, the answer is my great punchline. So how do we get to the punchline? Hayek's argument runs as follows. Now, again, this is the only part of this that you could even slightly consider to be technical, and I'm telling you it is not that technical. It basically follows from this simple insight. And the simple insight is that businessmen tend to engage in their in long-term investment projects when the interest rates are low rather than when they're high. Yeah, exactly. Isn't that amazing? And now you do not need to be a brain surgeon to see this. Presumably I don't need to draw you a diagram, because obviously the longer term the investment is, the more the interest payments are going to accumulate and compound and weigh on you. So conversely, as the interest rate comes down, suddenly projects that you wouldn't have even considered engaging in suddenly seem potentially profitable, because the payment will be manageable. So that's why the longest term investment tends to be the most interest rate sensitive. Okay, so this is a very simple, obvious, empirical point, and you can understand it theoretically why business would do that. Now, the only other thing I need to introduce that might be unfamiliar is a sort of terminology the Austrians use when we talk about the structure of production. We use the term higher order and lower order goods and industries. Higher order goods would be things that are far from finished consumer goods, like research and development. Nobody goes into a store and says, yeah, could I have 5 ounces of research and development? Like, no, a consumer doesn't buy that. So that's a higher order good, because it's not going to bear fruits for the consumer for a long time. So it's very remote from consumer goods, finished consumer goods. Or let's say expanding mining capacity. That takes years. Okay, so again, that's not going to bear immediate consumer fruits. So things that are time consuming and that are aimed at a long-term future production, we call higher order stages. So mining, raw materials, research and development, construction. And then we get down to the lower order stages, the stages that are very close to the consumer, like wholesaling. Now you're getting close. Now the product has been produced. Or retailing, marketing, where you're pitching the product to the consumer. Now you're getting close. Services, which are immediately consumed by the consumer. Now you're right at the consumer. So the difference between higher order and lower order stages would be, for example, wheat in a field versus a bagel in a bagel shop. So a good goes through various stages, and some are temporally remote, and then they get closer and closer until you have a finished consumer good. So this is, again, this is not difficult to understand. So now we combine these insights together. And what we see is that when the interest rate goes down, businesses tend to expand into the higher order stages of production, because those are the most time consuming, they're the most future oriented, they're going to take the longest, so they're the most interest rate sensitive. So that's when you see more R&D being done, when mining capacity is expanded, raw materials production is expanded. Okay, what Hayek is arguing is that this process, whereby low interest rates encourage businesses to engage in long-term investment, this is a good, wonderfully coordinating process for two reasons. Because how do the interest rates get low on a free market? They get low because we save, and our saving pushes the interest rate down. It's cheaper to borrow when the banks have more to lend. So we push the interest rate down when we save more. And when we save more, two things follow. The first thing that follows is that if I'm saving a portion of my paycheck and I'm not just going out and blowing every cent of my paycheck, what I'm implicitly saying is I'm going to postpone some of my consumption for the future. I'm not going to engage in all my consumption right away. I'm going to hold it off for the future. Well, there we see coordination because, as we've seen, businesses are engaged in long-term investment aimed at the future at the very time that consumers have indicated an increased desire to consume in the future. So the time matches up. But secondly, think about what happens when we don't blow every cent in our paycheck and we put some money in the bank. What happens is that since we're not buying as many hats and coats and toothbrushes, well, let's hope we keep buying toothbrushes, but that's a bad example. But for some reason, I always say toothbrushes, and I never mean to. Hats, coats, magazines, whatever, computer games. When we stop buying so many of those things, those industries, the consumer goods industries, the lower order stages, will start to contract because if we're not demanding as much of their product, well, we don't need as many of them anymore. So when those industries contract, they don't need as many workers anymore. They don't need as many trucking services anymore. They don't need as much steel anymore. And so what they're doing is they're releasing resources now that they no longer need. There's a lesser demand for consumer goods right now because we're saving. So you know what? We don't need all this trucking. We don't need all this stuff. And these released resources provide the physical material wherewithal for the businessman's long-term projects to be seen through to completion. The higher order stages can expand because resources to expand them are simultaneously released from the lower order stages. So there's a coordination that takes place. But here's the crux of Hayek's argument. Suppose interest rates come down not because the public has saved, not because the public has indicated it's going to consume more in the future. Let's suppose there's an intervention into the free market that artificially pushes the interest rate down. Now, notice the difference. The similarity is that in both cases, if interest rates come down, business will engage in long-term investment in the higher order stages. But the differences would be twofold. Number one, in this case, consumers have not indicated that they're going to postpone their consumption for the future. They want to continue consuming right now in the present. But yet businesses are engaged in long-term product development of new products, and people want existing products now. So there's a time mismatch. But secondly, if people have not increased their saving, then the consumer goods industries are not contracting. And therefore, they're not releasing trucking services and labor and steel and lumber and whatever for use in the higher order stages. So in other words, we're starting a whole lot of long-term investment, but the economy does not have the physical stuff necessary to see them all through to completion. They can't finish all these projects. The stuff isn't there. So instead of a harmonious coordination of resources released from the lower order stages, made available for use in the higher order stages, we instead have a tug of war going on in the economy over resources between the lower and higher order stages. And both sides can't win a tug of war. So there's going to be a massive discovery in the higher order stages that these projects, many of them are not profitable. They've got to be discontinued. It's been a waste to start them. We've wasted society's resources on them. So it's discoordination that comes about with this intervention. And the intervention, of course, is carried out by the central bank, in the American case, the Federal Reserve System. When it tries to force interest rates artificially low, well, surprise, forcing interest rates in a direction the free market doesn't want to take them does not yield you a utopia of, you know, kittens and lollipops and sunshine. It does not create bread from stones. If only it did. But all it does is discombobulate the economy. And Mises gives a very useful analogy that I always use because I think it really, really brings out the problem. He says, imagine the economy as being a home builder, a single master builder building a house. But he's building the house under the misleading impression that he's got a 20% greater supply of bricks than he actually has. Well, we know he can't ever finish the house according to the blueprint. He doesn't have the bricks for it. He doesn't know that. Now, would it be better for him to discover this error sooner or later? Well, obviously, the sooner he discovers it, the less resource waste he will have engaged in, and the less time he will have wasted as well. So it's better for him to learn this sooner. If he learns it at the very end as he's laying the last brick, that's terrible. He's wasted a lot of time. He may have to destroy the whole structure. He's wasted society's resources. He's made society poorer. So it's better for these errors to be discovered sooner rather than later. So the analogy Mises is making is that think of the master builder as being all the actors in the economy. And they're all engaged in production projects that are just incompatible with each other. We don't have the resources for them. There aren't, figuratively speaking, enough bricks to finish them all. So they're engaged in all these incompatible projects. And it's better that we find this out sooner so they don't waste their time on projects that aren't going to pan out. It's better for them to discover it sooner. Now, my addition to this analogy is to suggest, would it help the situation with the master builder? I mean, if he finds this out soon, then he can say, all right, wait a minute, I don't have as many bricks as I thought. I'll go back to my blueprint. I'll knock off the third floor. I'll cross out the gazebo, and then maybe I can make it work. And then you can have a sound production of the house. My question would be, would it help the situation if we just got the master builder drunk so that he didn't notice the dwindling supply of bricks? Well, obviously, the house is still unbuildable. No matter how happy he is, the house is still unbuildable. That doesn't help at all. But yet, that is the exact equivalent of saying, let's see, artificially low interest rates caused all these crazy investments, so what we need are lower interest rates, full steam ahead. But that's exactly what we're being told. That's exactly what we're being told. 1% interest rates caused this problem? Well, baby, time for zero. So in effect, they're saying, just liquor up that master builder. And my final point on this, before we go into some moral questions, is to look at the actual empirical example of the year 2001. Now, in the late 90s, we had this phenomenon of the NASDAQ bubble with all these internet companies that were bid up to crazy prices, and people thought they were going to become millionaires by investing in companies that had no, as far as we could see, no customers, no product, no profits. And this was, you won't be surprised to learn the Federal Reserve had a hand in that too. So the thing goes bust around 2000. Well, into 2001, Alan Greenspan comes to the conclusion, he's the chairman of the Federal Reserve, he comes to the conclusion that, you know what, I'm sick of being in a downturn. It's time to laugh again, to quote Homer Simpson. And so he in 2001, he lowered interest rates 11 times. And remember, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Well, this is the hammer he has, lower the interest rates, right? So he does this all through the year, and people were amazed that the recession was relatively mild. And so the New York Times referred to Greenspan as, I'm not making this up, I mean, this is creepy Pravda-style comment, that Alan Greenspan is the infallible maestro of our financial system. I mean, we're talking about one fallible guy, and they're gonna talk about him like that. So it looked like, hey, isn't that great? Well, look at what also happened in 2001 when Greenspan did that. Notice what the recession is. The recession is the economy's way of saying, wait a minute, we've been misled into doing the wrong thing. We way expanded too much here, and we've underexpanded here. We've got to shift resources around and get the thing going again. That's what the recession is. The recession is the master builder saying, wait a minute, I'm wasting resources. I better stop doing this. So the recession is the restoration to health. It is getting the economy on a healthy, sustainable footing, not this unsustainable, crazy footing. Well, Greenspan, 2001, gives us this short recession. People think, oh, wonderful, that's great. But in 2001, we've got the first recession on record in which housing starts did not decline. Housing starts continued upward. Because Greenspan, again, just in effect said, hey, full steam ahead, everybody. Just keep doing what you've been doing. I'm going to give you the credit to make it possible. So people drew the conclusion that housing apparently is robust even in a recession. I mean, apparently it just never goes down. And Fed economists told them this, that you know that house prices are just going to continue upward, and it's the best investment you can make, and you can flip houses, and it'll be wonderful. These myths get started precisely because Greenspan tries to liquor up the master builder and just basically say, just keep doing what you've been doing. So that when the bust came, it was all the worse because in the intervening years, the economy has continued along its unsustainable trajectory. So you can't make the bust go away by liquoring up the master builder. That's the point. The problem is that you're on an unsustainable path. And so that's what we have lived through, exactly an illustration of the Austrian thesis. Now, let me talk then about what sort of moral implications there are here. What I will say is that a crisis like this gives us an opportunity to ask fundamental questions. A systemic crisis leads you to ask fundamental questions. A minor crisis might lead you to say, well, maybe a little glue here, a little tape here, and we'll get the thing going again. But a major crisis makes you ask, or should make you ask, if we had a non-drone media, we would be asking things like, maybe there's something fundamentally wrong. Maybe somehow there's something in the structure itself that needs to be fixed. Well, these are the sorts of questions that I would suggest need to be asked during a systemic crisis. One would be, first of all, the system we have now gives rise to the business cycle, because we've now seen the solution to Hayek's question, why is the economy moving like this? And the answer is because the central bank manipulates money and credit and manipulates interest rates. Every entrepreneur is alert to the whole structure of interest rates throughout the economy. You can't interfere with it and expect this not to cause problems. And likewise, you can't interfere with it and then blame the consequences on the free market. You'll notice all of this involves an intervention into the free market. So this system that we have yields the business cycle. That's Hayek's insight. And it yields it particularly because in our system, the money we use can't be redeemed into anything. And we have this fractional reserve system as well. And so the central bank, the Fed, can create untold amounts of money and feed it into the banking system. And the banking system, in turn, that pushes interest rates down throughout the system. It's because it's got this sort of endless ability to pump money in and keep interest rates low. And this is provoking and causing severe business cycles. In fact, there couldn't have been a housing bubble. And when we use the term bubble, we just mean prices that are unsustainably high. There couldn't have been a housing bubble without a Federal Reserve System, because let's suppose people were just buying a lot of houses. Well, what would have happened? The banks would have run out of money to lend, and interest rates would have gone up, and that would have been the end of it. You wouldn't have had people speculating in housing, owning 5 houses and having no job, whatever. I mean, this couldn't have been possible. The financing for it wouldn't have existed. But if you have your Soviet commissar running money and interest rates, well, he can just pour in all the money he wants to, and suddenly the banks feel like they've got a ton to lend, and it pushes interest rates down, and it perpetuates these unhealthy asset bubbles. So the question would be, given that these things follow from the system that we have, should we rethink the system that we have? There's a moral effect brought about, one of many, by this fiat money system we have now. When we say fiat money, that term means that the money that's in use, it's like fiat lux in the Bible, let there be light. Well, fiat money is in effect like the government saying, let this be money, even though it's just a piece of paper, let this be money. And that system leads to, in my view, morally illicit redistributions of wealth from the poor and middle class to the politically well-connected. And this occurs by means of a mechanism called Cantillon effects. Because when the central bank, like the Fed, injects a lot of money into the economy, it doesn't do so by sending everybody an equal check for the amount, like we all get our proportional check in the mail. Or they don't fly a helicopter over the country and equally drop the dollar bills on everybody's heads. What in fact happens is certain parties get the newly created money first. It could be banks, it could be politically connected corporations that have government contracts, whatever. But whoever gets the money early on in the process gets to spend it before prices have commensurately risen. So these people enjoy a windfall. Well, who's providing the wherewithal for this windfall? Everybody else, the average person who doesn't happen to be particularly close to the monetary spigot. By the time he gets the money, all this time he's been, as prices are being bid up by the new money, he's been having to pay these new higher prices, but he doesn't have any of the new money yet. So this is a redistribution of wealth, as clear as day, as clear as can be, from the people who don't have political connections to people who do. Isn't there a moral aspect to this? So in other words, I'm saying that the crisis is an opportunity to ask fundamental questions about the monetary system. The monetary system that yielded us this crisis also has all this moral baggage. Under the system we have now, it is hard for families to save for the future. Because let's say you were going to save for the future and you decided the way you're going to do it is just pile up stacks of Federal Reserve notes, green paper dollar bills. And that's how you're going to save for your retirement. You've got a big room where you're throwing them. And then when retirement day comes, you're going to open that door and just bask in the money. Well, obviously, only a fool would do that. Because by the time you retire, it's lost 2/3 of its value at least. So therefore, what does the average person have to do, not even to make a gain, just to break even? Well, you've got to become a speculator. You've got to go in the stock market. You've got to try and buy this or that financial product. Most people have no business being in the stock market. It is a characteristic of a bubble economy that everybody thinks he can get rich quick in the stock market. That's when you know. In fact, John F. Kennedy's father, Joe Kennedy, said in 1929 when he took his money out of the stock market, he said, when you have an economy in which the local stock boy at the grocery store is giving you advice on, you know, on stocks, that's time to get out. It's overheated, okay? So, but what are people doing? Like, we don't all belong there, but we have to just to hold on to our wealth. Whereas in the 19th century, when precious metal coins, when they circulated as money, these coins held or increased their value over time. So if you wanted to save for the future, you could invest your money if you wanted to, but the point is you didn't have to. You could simply accumulate the coins. It is much easier. Now people are much more vulnerable, are in much more danger of being completely wiped out just because they're trying to defend themselves against a central bank that keeps debasing the money. And debasing the money is a moral issue. The first person to actually write a monetary treatise was Nicholas Oresme in the 14th century, a Catholic bishop. And it's an extremely good treatise on money, and he condemns the debasement of money, whereby in the old days, before they had paper money, where the government could just, you know, run the printing press and print up all they wanted, they couldn't print more gold or silver, which is why today we get all these complaints, oh, you couldn't have a precious metal money, it wouldn't be flexible enough. Yeah, it wouldn't be flexible enough for governments to just print up quantities of it, but that's actually a virtue of precious metal money. But this was considered to be theft by theologians, not just Oresme, but Juan de Mariana was a great 16th century Jesuit who wrote another treatise on the debasement of money. The Acton Institute published an English translation of this Latin treatise in its Journal of Markets and Morality not too long ago. Because what is it if not stealing? The king would take the coins and then clip some of the metal off it and then maybe insert some base metal back into it and give it back to them and demand that it circulate at face value. Meanwhile, he keeps the clippings. Well, in what definition of stealing does that not qualify? Well, okay, they don't clip the coins anymore because even the coins are crummy. So they just, you know, they do the equivalent. They run the printing press. And then they have a cadre of economists whose job it is to tell us that they're stabilizing the economy by doing this. They're not actually looting you, you understand. I've got some charts and graphs to show that this is actually a stabilization device. And they're not doing this to enrich themselves. It has nothing to do, I don't know, it's very cynical of you even to entertain that notion. We have the fact that every known example of hyperinflation has occurred under the system, the sort of system we have now. Hyperinflation is a type of inflation that we sort of arbitrarily define as consisting of 50% price inflation per month. Now, I forgot to say one thing, I'll jot it down. Now, hyperinflation, the best example people can think of normally because it was so dramatic was the German hyperinflation of 1923 when you had 4.2 trillion marks to the dollar. And it was an almost complete collapse of the currency. And my favorite story from that period, favorite in sort of a macabre sense, was of a guy who had accumulated a small fortune, 68,000 marks he deposited in the bank. The bank in 1923 sends him a letter saying, we have to close your account, and we're sorry we can't actually pay you the 68,000 because the smallest denomination bill in circulation now is 1 million marks. So we rounded up your deposit to 1 million so we could pay you. So that was the good news. The bad news was, how much did the stamp on the envelope cost? 5 million marks. So the guy was completely wiped out. Well, there is no example in all of history of a precious metal-based money yielding such a result. You will find no such thing. I will point out, by the way, in case the thought is, well, what about additional creation of gold and silver? Wouldn't that be inflationary? Well, yes, it would. But let's consider the numbers. If you look at the English silver pound from 1066 to about 1600, so a little over 500 years, it was debased by about a third. So including the debasement effort by the government and the increased supply, it's debased by, its value goes down by a third. Okay, so that's 0.3. So a 0.3 with a bar over it. So then we look at the next 200 years when we after we get modern banking, and the depreciation is not 0.3, it's 5. It's a factor of 5. Then we get 30 years in American history, 1973 to 2003, it's a factor of 16. So, okay, that's true, all monetary systems would have this problem. But let me also add in parentheses, what the Austrians argue is that the supply of money does not matter. Prosperity does not depend on how much money is in the system. Any supply of money can facilitate any number of transactions. All you need to do is just adjust the price level accordingly. There's no reason you do not need to increase the supply of money. So people may say, this is all in parentheses, by the way, people may say, well, then wouldn't it be socially wasteful? Let's say we went back to a system where the money was redeemable into or was in fact itself gold or silver. Given that we would never need, according to what I'm saying, we'd never need to increase the supply of money, wouldn't it be socially wasteful to continue to mine gold and silver in those conditions? And the two-part answer to that, still in parentheses, is we still do use gold and silver for non-monetary purposes, so it is still useful to mine them. But secondly, even if we didn't, what tends to happen is the supply of goods and services in the economy, in a progressing economy, increases in greater and greater abundance over time, and the supply of money tends not to match it. So the money is going to become more and more valuable over time. There'd be more and more goods and with a roughly stable, slightly increasing supply of money. So what would start to happen is that the coins would become so valuable that how would it be really useful to have a silver coin that could buy you a Cadillac? Like, how would you buy a loaf of bread with it? So unless you went around with microscopically small coins. So the continuing mining would help to deal with this problem of coin size. But that was just a parenthetical aside. We have the moral hazard problem. Moral hazard is this phenomenon by which people act with an artificially elevated level of risk tolerance because they think some sucker is going to pay if they make any losses. It is, by the way, the sort of phenomenon whereby people don't take care of a rental car as much as they take care of their own car. Like, it doesn't, you know, if I go 50 miles an hour over this speed bump, I'm not the one who has to bear the brunt of it. So it's that sort of phenomenon. Well, people have talked about this in connection with the financial crisis. Well, gee, what sort of effect do you think it would have on the financial industry if you know there is a monopoly paper money producer that has a monopoly on producing money out of thin air, can produce it in any quantity because it's paper or it's electronic. You don't have to mine it. There is no physical constraint on how much you can print up to bail out some company. Will that make you more or less risk averse? I mean, obviously, people understand. In fact, even the International Monetary Fund admitted, and if they admit something, that is a real sign because they never admit anything. April 2008, they issued a report saying, gee, it's funny, these financial firms, it seems like they're taking a lot of risks with their money and they're depending on the central bank to bail them out when they have liquidity problems. Oh, gee, that is funny, isn't it? And that's sort of funny that phenomenon is occurring. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, why in this industry, why is it that in the shoe industry or the hat industry, the whole industry is not debt-based, it's equity-based, 50, 60% equity ratios or 30% with cars. It's like 2 or 3% in the financial industry. Now, why is that? Because they've got the big sugar daddy paper money producer that they're very well connected with, and they figure, well, you know, they'll help us out. Well, I mean, again, do you think this is going to make you more or less risk-taking? And in fact, what it also means is that it encourages the wrong type of entrepreneur. It encourages a reckless risk-taker. And so that there were people during the 2000s who said, you know what, there's something wrong with the housing market. Something's just not right here, and we're not going to put our money into these mortgage-backed securities. We're just going to hang low and wait for this thing to collapse, and then we'll come in and really clean up. Well, if the government and the central bank don't let that happen, and they reward the people who did the wrong thing, and they refuse to let the people who did the right thing expand, they just look like chumps. They just look stupid. So the lesson to be learned for next time is don't keep your powder dry. Get caught up with whatever crazy thing it is. In fact, now they've made the too-big-to-fail firms even bigger. So how can they plausibly claim, all right, we bailed you out with trillions this time, but tomorrow that's it. If you guys go under, I mean, come on now, really. I mean, who could believe that? What kind of incentive effects is this going to have? Well, given that I am at my sort of time a few minutes after the hour, I will just sort of finish with this. These are the sort of questions that, as I say, are not generally being asked. They're being asked now more than ever, thankfully, or at least more than we've seen in maybe 70 years. But it's still considered sort of odd or crankish not to think that a monopoly paper money producer is the greatest advance in the history of mankind. But I would argue that it's actually crankish to think that. And that, to the contrary, when you talk about, it's one thing to say price controls don't work or subsidies are bad or whatever, standard free market sort of arguments, you know, people sort of go along with that. But even some supporters of the free market feel like it's kind of weird and crankish to favor a different monetary system, a sound money. But yet to me, I feel like this is actually the most defensible of all the free market positions. It is, the arguments for it are the most compelling, it is the most persuasive, and they're the most crucial for a free society. I mean, you may say, well, we should focus on things that are more politically feasible. I mean, the monetary system is not likely to change. Okay, that's true. But there are plenty of people who write policy papers about agriculture subsidies, so I don't feel like I need to do that. I'm going to focus on this sort of thing because somebody, it doesn't have to be me specifically because I'm just some little guy, but somebody has to influence public opinion. You can't just follow public opinion and say, well, you know, if we say anything different, we're never going to get anywhere. No, you're never going to get anywhere if you just follow. And that's what F.A. Hayek said in the late 1940s. He said, we need a movement that will not simply put forth what seems politically feasible at the time, because then we'll never get anywhere. We need, regardless of how slim the prospects seem to be, we need to be committed to all the principles of the free society, all the indispensable foundations of lasting prosperity. We need to be committed to these things and make the case for them, because it is vain to criticize an out-of-control government if you're going to say nothing about its magical money creation machine, because one feeds into the other. It is essential that we understand the role that it plays as we see our government grow larger and larger and larger, faster than any of us, even the most cynical among us, imagine possible. One needs to go to the root, to the heart, to the lifeblood of the system in order to make any lasting gains. And so it seems to me that instead of letting ourselves be misled into taking our cues from whatever the New York Times and Newsweek say happens to be respectable, whatever Ben Bernanke or Timothy Geithner says happens to be respectable, you know, I don't think they're respectable, because everything they've said has been proven wrong by events time and again, over and over and over and over. Maybe it's time instead to listen to people from the Austrian tradition who have an understanding of what happened to us, who predicted that it would happen, and who have a sound and sensible solution for getting us out of it. Because then, ladies and gentlemen, I think we would finally have change we can believe in. So thank you very much.
All right, folks. Now, as long as we're on this topic, I have a little announcement for you that you may want to hear. And that is April 11th, 2019. I'm pretty sure that's the date. Save that date, because that is when we are doing the New York premiere of the Bubble film, the documentary about what happened to the economy, and particularly from the housing standpoint, back in 2008. And it's really well done. It's more or less based on Meltdown. And we've premiered it, at least part of it, at Mises University this year. And so we're having a New York premiere. And that premiere will be followed up by a panel consisting of Gene Epstein, the great Jim Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, and David Stockman of the Reagan administration. I'll have more details for you coming up. You can always find my events at tomwoods.com/events. I don't think I even have anything posted there these days because I'm not doing much public speaking, but that's where you'll find it. But also, you got to get on my newsletter list, right? You have to. Okay. Let's have a little talk here. You like the show. Maybe you think to yourself, I already get enough Tom Woods. If I also got the newsletter, it would be just too much. And you're looking at this all wrong. You're thinking about too much of a good thing, but that's a myth, right? How could you have too much of a good thing? That's silly, right? If it were, it would become a bad thing. But there's nothing that I'm doing here that would ever become a bad thing. An email in your inbox on a weekday is not going to make you sad. It's going to make you happy. You're going to say, there's old Woods fighting a good fight for me. You know, let me open this up and see what he's up to today. It's going to be part of your day that you're going to look forward to. Okay, so I want you to hop on that list because that's how I'm going to tell you the logistical details for this incredible event where you get a chance to meet all these great folks. So how do you hop on my list? You go to tomwoods.com, and at the top of the page, you'll see a button to click. You can go to bernieiswrong.com and get my ebook on Bernie Sanders. So many ways to hop on my list. So do that so I can inform you about this event, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.